We wanted to take a moment to mark President Joe Biden's announcement that United States troops will exit Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. It's the end of a military engagement that marked a turning point in U.S. foreign affairs. There are millions of adult Americans who grew up knowing only this conflict, seemingly a war without end. Will this represent a new chapter? For everyone who worked, sacrificed, or lost family in Afghanistan, this is a deeply mixed bag of feelings. Michigan's 3rd District Congressman Peter Meyer, Republican from Grand Rapids, joins us now. Congressman, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Pleasure to be here.
You tweeted this week that you're glad President Biden made this decision and made the announcement. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, absolutely. So initially, we had been slotted under the terms of the Doha agreement that had been negotiated with the Trump administration to withdraw all forces from Afghanistan by May 1st. Currently, we have around 2,500 military personnel in Afghanistan. So it's very much a residual presence that's mostly just involved in securing some of the remaining bases we have. But to your earlier point, it's definitely a bittersweet moment, but better than prolonging the inevitable.
Few people who follow Afghanistan believe that the current president, Ashraf Ghani, will be able to stay in power very long after the U.S. departs. If the goal was to stabilize a region that hosted hostile actors, can we really rationalize ending this operation?
Well, I think we have to remember what we went into Afghanistan for back in 2001, almost 20 years ago, and that was to deny al-Qaeda, an international terrorist organization, sanctuary. We're currently caught up in the midst of a civil war that we are able to be played off by both sides. And the reality is that the Kabul government has never exerted full control over the Afghan territory. Right now, it's frankly, a country that is weaker than the sum of its parts. Many regional actors and former warlords or current warlords hold a lot more sway. And the presence of international forces and U.S. support for the Kabul-based government has really precluded the serious negotiations and resolution of the conflict that's required.
The Doha Agreement calls for the Taliban to make this commitment not to kill Americans. The terms of that agreement had U.S. troops leaving by May 1st. What do you think will happen if American troops or personnel are attacked or killed between May and September?
I think we will respond back vigorously and defend the security of our personnel who are there. And we retain that ability even after troops leave in order to make sure that we are able to mitigate terrorist threats. But the sad reality is that our broader ambitions, as they began to morph and as we had mission creep over the past 20 years from that simple notion of denying sanctuary to al-Qaeda so they couldn't plan and execute international terrorist incidents, that's been accomplished, and we need to rationalize, our ongoing efforts in the region.
The thing is, the Taliban are likely to play an important role, the same group that offered al-Qaeda sanctuary in the first place. The Taliban are likely to play an important role going forward. The Biden administration is trying to structure some talks between the Ghani regime and the Taliban and possibly some other stakeholders, the hope being that some power-sharing agreement can be reached, although prospects for that aren't super strong right now. Do you think we need to prepare ourselves for the eventuality of the Taliban retaking power?
I don't think it'll be as simple as the Taliban retaking power. And to be honest, when you get outside of Kabul, there's a lot less daylight between the Taliban and regional forces, as I think many in the West appreciate. I spent 2013 to 2015 in Afghanistan as a conflict analyst for the aid community. So, from the outside, it seems to be a very black and white conflict, but it's anything but when you start to dive into the weeds and into the nuances of the regional conflict and the inter-Afghan disputes.
There's no question that there are many, many seats at this table. But in the past year or so, assassinations have been ticking upward against judges, against journalists, women in prominent jobs. It feels like it's not hard to see where this might be headed again.
And that's really been a campaign of intimidation that's been ongoing for the past several decades. When we look at the civilian fatalities, and it's not just the fatalities of being perpetrated by the Taliban, but it's also civilians caught up within the fighting. The reality is that this is not a conflict that will be solved through military action alone. It will require a power-sharing agreement, and that's been something that we frankly started to negotiate back in 2001. So pre-invasion in October and November. So the Taliban view themselves as a government in exile. There is hope that there will be an ability to have those regional power-sharing agreements that recognize some of the historic tribal and ethnic prerogatives and frankly, get away from this notion that we can just revamp a society when we're not willing to commit the forces, the time, the money, the blood and treasure to see that happen.
How do you define U.S. interests in Afghanistan at this moment?
Stability. I think that's the best that we can hope for. And again, stability is only going to arise through power sharing agreements. We've been turning the corner, in the words of generals and political officials, for the better part of two decades. And the joke in the veterans community has been, you know, we've turned the corner so much we have to be in a maze by now. And I think we have to be willing to align our ambitions with what we're willing to commit.
The costs of engagement in Afghanistan include, but certainly are not limited to, more than 2,300 American lives. The estimates of civilian deaths in country vary. They might number around 40,000, according to one review from Brown University. There are many, many more people in Afghanistan who were displaced. In total, do you think the losses have been justified, in your view?
I think, and this on the military side, as a veteran who served in Iraq and actually participated in that drawdown from 2010 to 2011, it's hard to look back or to look at a current moment, you know, with the anticipated withdrawal, with anything short of a feeling of bittersweet. This is not choosing between a great outcome and a bad outcome. It's trying to find the least worst possibility. And acknowledging the fact that if we continue the status quo, we're putting more American lives at risk. We're frankly putting more Afghan civilian lives at risk as well. It's better to face the reality now than to draw out the inevitable.
Iraq's actually kind of a tempting case study here. These are two very different countries, but the United States went through periods of drawdown followed by periods of reengagement. Do you think that the whole idea of a withdrawal, full stop, is perhaps misleading when we think about our engagement in Afghanistan in coming years?
When I consider withdrawal, I mean the physical presence of large numbers of U.S. troops. We'll still maintain diplomatic and intelligence capabilities. We'll still retain kinetic capabilities as well, but it'll be shifting, frankly, to the airstrikes that have been the marker of this conflict, at least for the past 5 years. So, you know, when you talk about Iraq, you know, that we had in Iraq, one regional power, Iran, that really emphasized and drew a wedge between the Shia and Sunni populations, and in ways that the American presence in the final days of that conflict in 2010-2011 really exacerbated by failing to check the Maliki government and the way that they marginalized the Sunni community. So in some ways, you know, it's tempting to draw that analogy, but in other ways, I think we have to realize that when we're caught in the midst of a civil war, the only solution is going to be a political one.
One might argue that there's a parallel situation with the Taliban and Shia in Afghanistan. Do you think that's a relevant comparison?
When you speak of the Shia in Afghanistan, do you mean the Hazara population?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Hazara in Afghanistan are a much smaller minority that lack significant outside support. So the Shia in Iraq were, you know, de facto Iranian elements. In Afghanistan, the Hazara are very much a repressed minority in many places and have found themselves the target of some of the more nihilistic elements of the opposition to the government. When it comes to their protection, you know, we've seen in the past that there have been agreements between the Taliban and the Hazaras. So I'm obviously concerned about the future of that population, but they have the historical retrenchment into alliances that predated 9/11, that predated the Soviet invasion, really call for a more comprehensive, you know, tying together of those fabrics. And again, that's something that cannot happen when you have the largest ethnic groups very much at war with the central government, but over what are oftentimes parochial or territorial disputes that can be resolved.
Part of what brought the United States to this place is the authorization for use of military force that was passed in 2001. Tell us about how quickly you think Congress needs to move to amend or end the authorization.
I've been a part of bipartisan efforts, and including sponsoring a piece of legislation with several veterans on both sides of the aisle to repeal the 2002 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF, that authorized our engagement against Saddam Hussein in the 2003 war, in addition to the 91 AUMF for the Gulf War and a 57 AUMF that's still on the books from the Eisenhower era. So I firmly believe we need to repeal those full stop, and then focus on reforms of the 01 AUMF. I've always tried to disconnect those 01 AUMF reforms from the operations in Afghanistan, because the operations in Afghanistan were what that was intended to do, to go after al-Qaeda and associated forces. Now, we ended up using that 01 authorization to conduct operations in 18 other countries, you know, throughout Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, and in parts of Sub-Saharan Africa as well. So I think it's important that we address that expanse of the global war on terror, but also in ways that increase accountability. So I do not support a full repeal just yet of the 01 AUMF, but rather a reform of that process that targets authorizations based more narrowly on geography, on target, and then also having some type of time-bound element so that Congress has to reauthorize and approve rather than just letting these conflicts continue on autopilot.
Peter Meyer represents Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. He's joining us today from Washington. Congressman Meyer, thank you for your time.
Thank you, April.